Augustine of Hippo. How many of you, please raise your hand, how many of you have heard of Augustine? Okay, why is Augustine important? We are going to give 2 weeks to thinking about Augustine, and there are a few of our sheets left if you need to grab one there at the soundboard. Why is it important for us to take some extra time to think about just one character in church history? What is so important about Augustine? So let me kind of give you several reasons why it is important to think about Augustine. Augustine is the most important theologian in the Western Church, which is our tradition. Both Catholics and Protestants try to quote him and claim him as their own. Augustine fought the battle in his lifetime of salvation by grace. So there is an ongoing challenge, really, of the devil against the core doctrine of salvation by grace through faith. And Augustine led the charge against a works-based theology in his own lifetime and really laid the foundation for everything that has come since then. He is also important because he dealt with issues of the sovereignty of God and kind of helping us understand how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as having freedom of the will, and he talked about the freedom of the will, but he merged that understanding with the sovereignty of God. And so he had to fight a couple of different battles, so to speak. One of them was against fatalism, and the other one was against a salvation based on works. And so in doing those, he kind of worked out a theology of human freedom and responsibility and how that correlates with, how that meshes with the sovereignty of God over all things, including our salvation. So he fleshed out some very important theological issues. He also has influenced Western culture as much as anybody. So, how many of you have heard of just war theory? Has anyone heard of just war theory? That it is sometimes right to go to war in defense of your land and loved ones? Okay, that we consider that to be just war theory, that there is a reason sometimes to go to war. He may have even given a theological defense of preemptive strike, but nevertheless, that has been the guide of the American theory of war for all of our existence, as well as really the Western Europe, European theory of when it is right and when it is wrong to go to war. So he has had a tremendous influence, not just in Christianity, but in Western culture itself. So we are going to, may I say, boring or not, we are going to talk about Augustine, and I'll do my best to avoid that. So those are the reasons that he is important. Charles Spurgeon used to say that you had these quote-unquote stepping stones in Christian theology, and he said that you put one foot on Paul, the next stepping stone was Augustine, the next stepping stone was Calvin, the next stepping stone were the Puritans. And so that was his sort of tradition of theology that he thought was the most important in Christianity. And he was a Baptist, okay? So he's similar to us in so very many ways. And those were the sort of stepping stones in Christian theology that he thought were the most important over the last 2,000 years. Paul, Augustine, Calvin, and the Puritans. So he is an important figure. We're going to talk about him and his life, but also about his theology and his legacy. Any comments? Okay, go ahead. Correct. Yes. Yeah. All right, here we go. Augustine was born in 354 AD in a small town called Tagaste in North Africa. So much of his life is spent in Northern Africa, which kind of should remind us that although Northern Africa has been primarily overrun, really, by Islam, it was very much part of the fertile soil of the birthplace of Christianity. And now I know the birthplace of Christianity is Palestine. I understand that. But it spread to Northern Africa before it spread really into Northern Europe. So where we would be from, if you kind of have an English heritage, Africa was Christian much sooner than, let's just say, you know, kind of Germany and England were. All right, his father was a Roman official, a relatively minor Roman official, and followed the traditional pagan religion. And so you will remember, as we've talked about the what was kind of termed the empirical church, once Constantine was converted, there was this kind of constant struggle between Christianity and the traditional pagan religions, and sometimes there would be kind of an attempt to revive the pagan religions. In fact, some people during Augustine's life said that the Germanic tribes from the north were able to conquer the city of Rome and basically scatter the power of the empire because they had abandoned their original Roman pagan gods. And he has to write his greatest book in defense of Christianity because so many people at the time were saying, well, Rome was conquered because Rome abandoned her original pagan gods. Well, his father was a part of that traditional pagan religion. His mother's name was Monica. She, however, was a devoted Christian, and she tirelessly prayed for her husband's conversion, and apparently, eventually, he did become a Christian. Augustine was a gifted child. Both of his parents recognized this. They wanted the best possible education for him, and he was sent first to a neighboring town called Madura, and then later on to Carthage. He was 17 when he arrived at Carthage to kind of finish out his education. Carthage, there in northern Africa, was sort of the cultural capital of the region. He studied very diligently, but he also was determined as a young man to sort of sow his wild oats and experience and enjoy the pleasures of city life. Shortly after he arrived, so he's still a teenager, he acquired a concubine who fairly quickly bore him a son, and Augustine's son was named Adeatus, I suppose is how to pronounce that, which means given by God. He himself is not a Christian. He's been taught the Christian faith by his mother, but he is not yet a Christian at this point. here are some of his early... any comments or questions? Early on in his studies there in Carthage, he studied rhetoric. So rhetoric was very important. It was the study of eloquence. So young men who were preparing to go into politics, the law, or kind of the governmental bureaucracy often would study rhetoric and this art of speaking and writing eloquently. They weren't necessarily interested in the truth. They were interested in convincing and persuading their audience. Truth was left to the philosophers. So he was not a philosophy student per se. He studied some philosophers, but more for their style than for their content. However, as a part of that, he was required to study Cicero, who himself was very eloquent in his writings, but was a philosopher. And Cicero's philosophy specifically put Augustine on a trek, on a quest for the truth. He decided that speaking with style wasn't enough, that he needed to know that what he was saying and what he was communicating was the truth itself. So he kind of goes on a journey. This, you know, he's still relatively young. He decides to find himself, so to speak. Okay, he's college age here, and he wants to find the truth. Any questions about this? or comments? All right. So part of this trek, this quest for the truth, is Manichaeism. And he kind of vaguely converts, although he never becomes a full convert. So Manichaeism was started in Persia sometime in the 200s AD by a spiritual leader named Mani. So therefore, Manichaeism is the name of this religion. It is basically a sort of philosophy with religious overtones, or maybe a religion with philosophical overtones. It is a dualistic religion and philosophy. It claims that both in the universe and in us personally, there are two basic realities. There is light and dark. There is good and evil. There is spirit and matter. And salvation in this religion is being able to sort of separate those two and to allow the spiritual good lightness in you to travel out to experience the pure light. So once again, we see this dualism of the material and the spiritual, and that the spiritual quest is to release the spiritual from the material and experience some form of what we would think of as non-material existence, like nirvana, like the Hindu version of nirvana. All right? So just before you kind of read through the rest of the notes, what's wrong with that dualism? Just to get your thinking process is going, and what is wrong with that dualistic approach to reality or to religion or to thinking about God or ourselves? Go ahead, Jen.
Well, we would have to do work to separate.
Okay, so there is a works-based, basically it is a works-based religion, once again, yes. Anything else? Okay, sounds New Age-ish, certainly does, yeah. There is nothing especially new about the New Age, yes. Okay, Jen?
It also implies that we can be perfect.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Jenny? How can you be pure light? Yes, this is Star Wars. You are exactly right. Okay, it does leave some core questions answered. There is no revelation in this, right? There is no scripture, no Bible. Now, there was, we'll get to that in a minute. Or maybe I didn't even write it down, but I'll explain that in a moment. Okay, so I'll just explain that now. Mani basically said that this idea of light and dark, material and spiritual, good and evil, dualistically existing in the universe, that this idea has been revealed to the prophets down through the ages, that it was revealed to Moses, that it was revealed to Jesus, that it was revealed to Buddha. No, wait. Buddha would be after him. There was a Zoroaster. He said it was revealed to Zoroaster, and then that it was revealed to him. He was in the long line that included Jesus and him that knew this truth, this dualistic reality of the truth. So, but here's what's really wrong with this problem. God created the material. God created the physical world. And God repeatedly said, and it is good, and it is good, and it is good. And so this idea that the material is bad is diametrically opposed to the divine revelation of the scriptures. That Judeo-Christian theology is unique in this, in affirming the goodness of God's creation. And in the incarnation, here at Christmas time, as we think about that, God, writ large, his approval of the material and of the physical human body by Jesus coming in a physical human body. And so any dualistic sort of separation of good and evil that is equated to spiritual and material, spirit is good, material is bad, is false. And that makes us careful about the way that we interpret the New Testament. Because when the New Testament talks about the world in a negative way, it is talking about the sinful choices of the world, not about the physical world. And when the scriptures speak about the flesh in a negative way, in the New Testament, it typically is referring to the sin nature. Now, there's maybe a little bit more to that because our flesh is especially susceptible to the sin nature. But, so is our spirit, okay, susceptible to the sin nature. So, some of that language has to be very carefully interpreted, even in the New Testament, so that we do not become Manichees. That was, if you weren't a Christian, you were a Manichee or you were a pagan. That was the term that was used. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be Gnostic. We don't want to be Manichees in our theology, even though we're reading the Bible. All right? And so that is the primary issue there. Now, there were a couple of reasons that this Manichaeism appealed to Augustine. These were problems that he had with his mother's Christianity. So he had been taught Christianity. He knew some basics of Christian theology, and these were problems that he had. First of all, he's into rhetoric. He wants to speak and write with clarity and with style. And when he reads the Bible, there's blood and guts all over the place. All right? And there are references to violence and sin in a relatively crude manner. There are references to rape. I've been reading in 1 and 2 Kings recently in my personal devotions, and some of the enemies of God's people tore open the bellies of pregnant women. Just horrible, horrible kinds of references in the scriptures. And he's thinking, there are better ways to say things about violence than just sort of spilling it out there like that. And so he has an objection to sort of the crude style in which the scriptures are sometimes written. And not only that, if we were able to read in Hebrew and Greek, some of the Hebrew is just gloriously flowing and beautiful. Isaiah is beautiful. The Psalms and other places, it's just so beautifully put. But other places are less rhetorical, less eloquent. And the same is true in the New Testament. So you have some precision in the writings of Paul. You have beautiful Greek in the book of Hebrews and in the book of James, but some of the rest of it's pretty rough. I mean, 1 and 2 Peter not only are different from one another in their style of Greek, they can be pretty crude in their style of Greek. And so you don't find what he would have known to be sort of flowing and eloquent. It's not there in the Bible as much as he would have liked for it to be, so he objected because of that. And then also, he was attracted to Manichaeism because it has this dualism. It has God and the devil, so to speak. It has good and evil as two relatively equal forces in the universe. And that is attractive to him because he asked the question essentially of his mother's religion, how is it that there can be, what my mother says, an infinitely good God, infinitely powerful, and also infinitely good? How could he allow evil? Well, the Manichees, they offered this answer. Well, there is a God, but there is also They didn't say a devil, but they said there is good and evil. There is God and the devil, or a devil, that oppose one another in the universe, and they must be separated. And the problem with humanity is that the good and the evil have become mixed, and we have to separate them and allow the good, the spiritual, to escape. And so that provided him with an answer to the problem of evil, the problem of original evil. All right, any comments or questions on this? That also is a problem, by the way, with Manichaeanism. It basically makes God equivalent to the devil in power and strength as two equal realities in the universe. Go ahead. Yes. And like Augustine, some of them became Christians. In fact, he was part of bringing some of them to Christ. His first written works were, you know, a big sort of like, oops, I was wrong. And he converted some of his friends to Manichaeism. And then he wrote a book or two to try to convert them to Christianity. But it's basically gone, although the themes, I mean, we've seen these themes before in Gnosticism, and you see them again in Hinduism and in the New Age movement in our country. So, I know so little about Scientology that I'm unsure how to answer, but apparently so. Yeah, okay. Yes, Heather has made a study of Scientology. Oh, okay.
Scientology is what they claim to be, is the improvement of self and sort of very almost evangelical zeal to change the world. We're going to change the world. But when you get down to the brass tacks and whatnot, it basically not. Very strong mafia like tendencies.
Okay. Right. Okay. And why do these movie stars like Scientology? I know, but I mean, they have to confess their sins and give over their money. That just doesn't seem to make sense because they got a lot of sins and a lot of money. Oh. Okay. Okay.
And that they will literally, you know, do their laundry for them and clean for them.
Okay, so philosophically, at least at this sort of surface level, it sounds different to me, but nevertheless. All right, but yes, you know, Manichaeism is just yet another version of this dualistic approach to philosophy, the universe, truth, and even personal experience of good and evil. Okay. Now, he would express his doubts. I mean, Augustine is brilliant, or was brilliant. And so he would express his doubts, and the people would express the formal people who had actually joined the Manichaeanism, they would try to answer him, and it wouldn't satisfy him. And so they said, you just wait until Faustus comes. So there was this great leader of Manichaeism who was named Faustus, which is kind of interesting because isn't that a name for the devil? I think, or... Okay, Heather? Okay, he made a deal with the devil. Okay, so there's some connection to the devil. Anyway, so Faustus would come. Faustus was supposed to come and answer all of his questions. But when Faustus came, it was very unsatisfying, very dissatisfying to him. His answers weren't any better than anybody else's. So here's kind of what happens. He got tired of his job in Carthage, basically. His students, by this time he's teaching rhetoric, his students were particularly unruly. So he moved to Milan. Now, Milan is in Italy, all right? And so he moves to Milan, and there he begins to espouse Neoplatonism. And we're just going to kind of dive into that here for just a moment. But this is kind of another step for him in some ways towards Christianity. So let me explain Neoplatonism just as quickly as I can. Neoplatonism emphasizes study, personal discipline, and mystical contemplation. So a little bit of okay, going on here, along with some personal discipline and study. And you were supposed to be able to approach the ineffable one, the unknowable one, through this discipline of Neoplatonism. It was also a philosophy with religious overtones, and it explained the origin of evil differently than Manichaeism. So Neoplatonism claimed that there was only one reality in the world, and that is the ineffable one. And so many of these philosophers, including Plato, they were so close to being monotheists. All right, they thought of a supreme being, and some of them believed that the Greeks and Romans created the whole sort of array of gods and goddesses only to sort of justify their own sinful behavior. We've talked about that before. And so they had this idea of a supreme being. And so you have that here again in this new version of Platonism, Neoplatonism, and that all realities in the rest of the world are defined by essentially their distance from the supreme good, the supreme being, the quote-unquote unknowable, ineffable one. And so here we have, in this new philosophy that Augustine is espousing, you don't have two equal forces in the universe of good and dark, of God and evil, or good and evil. You don't have that sort of competing tension there. Basically, they define evil as, have you turned away from the supreme being or the supreme good? Or are you moving towards? Are you coming closer to the supreme being? So that's why they disciplined themselves. That's why they studied. That's why they meditated, so that they could become closer to the supreme good. Let me just ask you this question. This isn't a trick question. Does this sound closer to Christianity than Manichaeism? Okay, it's not the whole truth, but it is, for Augustine, a step towards the truth of Christianity, that there is one supreme being and that good or evil in this world can be defined as distance from the ineffable one, the supreme being. Now, by the way, how would we define good and evil? This is actually simple. How do we define good and evil in relationship to the one true God? Yes. By what the Bible says. How does the Bible define good and evil in relationship to God? It's not by distance. It's by obedience or disobedience. Okay, so you can define obedience as being closer to God. You can speak of it in that way. But, you know, Neoplatonism isn't exactly the same as the Bible. We talk about obedience and disobedience. That's what is good and evil. All right? And that's because God has revealed himself. He is not unknowable to us because he has revealed himself and he's told us what to do and not to do. Therefore, good is obedience and evil is disobedience. Go ahead. So they would say that it does not exist independently from, it is not its own reality. It is defined as being way away from the supreme good. It's more of a direction than it is a reality on its own. You know, they just wouldn't answer that question, Don. They wouldn't say what's the source of that. Yeah, they wouldn't, as far as I know, and I don't know that much about Neoplatonism, they just would say there isn't an answer to that question. And Augustine is going to answer that question, but he is going to kind of hold on to a little bit of, he does not want there to be two equal powers in the universe like Manichaeism. So he's going to walk a tight wire when he answers that question. So, but we're not going to get there today. All right, so that breaks down his objection to Christianity when it comes to original evil. He has a philosophical way to say that there is only one primary reality in the universe, and that is God. All right, and so that breaks down the sort of what is the origin of evil objection to his objections to Christianity. And the other one is the crudeness, the quote-unquote crudeness of the Bible. And so at this time, he's living in Milan, right? And his mother is there with him, Monica, and she convinces him to go and listen to the beautiful, eloquent preaching of Ambrose. Now, we've talked about Ambrose before, right? We've mentioned him a couple of times. Ambrose is the bishop of Milan that had so much conflict with the emperor and the emperor's wife. Remember Eudoxia? Do you remember these? Oh, I'm sorry. That was somebody else. Let me back up. So Ambrose of Milan has a lot of conflict with the emperor. And remember the emperor brought in a very rich gift, laid it on the altar, and Ambrose waited and waited and waited to humiliate the emperor. Then he received the gift. So this is that Ambrose of Milan, and he is preaching eloquently and beautifully. Augustine goes at first just to hear him based on his style. Why wouldn't he go and hear the best speaker in town? He goes to hear the eloquence, the rhetoric of Ambrose, but he increasingly becomes interested in the content of the sermons. And because Ambrose, like so many other preachers and theologians at the time, interpreted the Bible allegorically, then it removed some of the sense of crudeness. So we have not entirely gotten away from allegorical interpretation ourselves. So if I were to preach from the Old Testament on idolatry, I would say that this is, you know, despicable, you know, sacrifices of, let's say, children to Molech. But I would eventually talk about how our idolatries of, you know, money or materialism or whatever harms our children. Well, that's a sort of a different application, isn't it? I'm not breathing down your neck saying, stop offering your children to the sacrifices of the gods, you know. I am saying, you know, stop living for selfishness for the benefit of your children. Now, Ambrose would have a much more allegorized interpretation of the scriptures. He might even say that some of these things didn't necessarily even happen, that they were meant to sort of communicate a spiritual truth or something like that. But nevertheless, it removed sort of the sharp edges of some of the crudeness of the scriptures for him. Now, I think that the scriptures are to be taken more literally in their interpretation, but that particular style of interpretation removed some of this crudeness from the Bible for Augustine, and he embraced some of that more allegorical kind of interpretation of the Bible. So, he is now starting to read the Bible. His intellectual objections have been removed. But he didn't necessarily want to give up his lifestyle, okay? And because of the monastic emphasis at the time, he assumed that he would have to become celibate for him to become a Christian. Now, we can just say this very clearly. You know, what a bunch of hooey. You don't have to become celibate to be a Christian. Why would the New Testament contain so many instructions to parents, okay, if you did? But he thought that that would have to be true for him. He probably, in his especially gifted mindset, assumed that if he became a Christian, he would have to go into the ministry, and he equated the ministry with a celibate lifestyle. At this time, he would pray this prayer, and because he wrote it in his confessions, it has become famous. Give me chastity and continence, which is essentially the same as celibacy. Give me chastity and continence, but not too soon. You know, but how many of us have thought something similar, right? I need to conquer this sin tomorrow. Give me chastity and continence, but not too soon. One day, he, perhaps out of just angst and anguish of soul, reading the book of Romans, he kind of fled to a garden for privacy. He couldn't stand the sort of the company of his more worldly friends. And so he goes, and this spiritual battle is raging within him. And over the garden wall, some children are playing, and for some reason, unknown to anybody really, one of the children in playing cries out in a sing-song kind of way, take up and read, take up and read, take up and read. I don't know if that was the ancient equivalent of London Bridges falling down, or I don't know. What, take up and read, take up and read, take up and read. He considered that to be a word from God. And so he had thrown aside a manuscript of the book of Romans. He had thrown that aside, perhaps out of just this battled anguish of his soul, perhaps out of frustration with the true plan of salvation by grace. And also in the anguish of knowing what he was going to have to give up to become a Christian in his sensuality. So he says, you know, God has told me to take it up and read again. He just opens it up and he reads the words of the Apostle Paul from Romans 13:13-14. Let us walk properly as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and sensuality, but in not in quarreling and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. So don't allow the sinful nature to control you, essentially, is what he's talking about there. But of course, he interpreted that as a need for celibacy. And at that point, he surrendered himself to God. He surrendered himself to the Lord and was converted at that point. One of the most significant conversions in all of Christian history because of his writings subsequently. He was baptized. Isn't this something? He was baptized along with his son, you know, his, you know, really illegitimate child because he had never married his son's mother, by Ambrose, that we've referred to here in previous weeks and this morning. Monica had persuaded him to dismiss his concubine after many years, and he never even mentions her name. Now, I don't know if Ambrose had anything to say about this, but I can guarantee you that as a pastor, if someone in Augustine's situation came to me, I would say, marry her, you know, not dismiss her. He had provided for her all along the way, but nevertheless, he casts her aside and really probably should not have done so. Although he may have, I don't know this for sure, but he may have provided for her once he left her. And also, she may not have been a Christian, and she may not have wanted to become one. And so we shouldn't judge him too harshly. But he sets her aside and takes his son and his mother and some friends back to northern Africa. They go to Tagaste, but on the way, before they even get to Tagaste, his mother dies. It takes him several weeks to sort of recover from the grief. And he goes to Tagaste. He sells off a lot of his property and ends up in another community. It's hard for me to say. Cassia Caicum, something. He ends up in another community, and he sets up basically a monastery. This is not the sort of most austere of all monasteries. They want not a aesthetic lifestyle. They want an orderly lifestyle, not extreme rigor, as many other monks were doing at that time. And then shortly after setting that up, his son dies as well. So he is completely sort of on his own except for this community. Now I want to begin to talk about his contribution, the contribution of his theological legacy. But do you have any comments or questions on what we've talked about so far? All right, well, let me just tell you kind of the rest of this part of the story, and then next week we'll talk about three primary theological issues and two primary writings of Augustine. But basically, at some point, he travels from this community that's so hard to say, and he goes to Hippo, another place in northern Africa, and he attends church there. The reason that he is gone is he wants to talk to a friend about coming back to this community and living in this monastic lifestyle with him, with some of the other quote-unquote monks that are with him. And in doing so, he goes to church. He goes to the primary sort of cathedral of the town of Hippo. And the bishop there, named Valerius, the bishop there walks up to the pulpit, or the equivalent of the pulpit at the time. He looks out into the crowd. He sees Augustine. Augustine has by this time written a couple of works that have become well known at the time. And so he sees Augustine, and he decides on the spur of the moment to change his sermon. And he preaches on how God provides shepherds for the flock. And he asks the people, please pray, just in case that this very day, perhaps, God has sent us a shepherd to assist in the shepherding of this flock. And so they did. And they looked around and said, well, look at there. There is Augustine. He should be a co-pastor with Valerius. And it's exactly what Valerius wanted to happen. And even though they didn't appear to know it, there was a rule against having two bishops in one congregation. Valerius ordained him anyway and made him a bishop. If you were not a bishop, you remember how we've talked about presbyters and bishops? Kind of there's a difference at this point in the terminology. If you were a presbyter, you were allowed to leave and go to another church. If you were a bishop, you were never allowed to leave your city. I mean, you could leave the city, but you could never leave your post as of being a bishop of that city. And so he quickly made him a bishop, and so now Augustine can never leave that position, that post of being bishop of Hippo. He's got an associate pastor for the rest of his life to help minister there, and that is what brings Augustine to the city of Hippo. He becomes known as Augustine of Hippo, and even though there was a rule that you couldn't have two bishops in one congregation, neither one of them seemed to know it about that rule. And there you have it, two bishops in this congregation of Hippo. We will talk next week. I'll probably review that little bit of the story because it's kind of cool. and then we will talk about his three primary theological contributions and two of his most important writings next week. But they're listed there. He talks about freedom of the will, in contradiction to what he had learned in Manichaeism. He talks about just war theory in contradiction to the Donatists of the day, and he talks about salvation by grace in contradiction to Pelagius, who, by the way, was from Britain. And then his two most important works are the Confessions of Augustine and the City of God. All right, any comments or questions on these things? All right. You're dismissed. Thanks for listening.